Welcome back to another episode of the Jewish Moves Podcast. This week's episode is with Adam Edelman. He's an Olympian who represented Israel in bobsledding at the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. He coaches for Maccabi USA, has given TEDx talks, was a Forbes 30 Under 30 member, and has done so much more. Adam, welcome to the show. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for agreeing to join. I guess we'll start from where your journey started, which is bobsledding. My impression is that you did not begin to bobsled at such a young age, and you had quite the journey to lead up to it. So can you walk us through those early stages?
The early stages of being an athlete or the early stages of a skeleton and bobsled?
I think both.
So the early stages of my sports endeavors was playing hockey when I was a really young kid. So our family was very much into being active. My parents, to their immense credit, thought that it would provide us an outlet for our creativity, for our development. And so we were encouraged to pursue sports and athletic activities. For my older brother, Alex, and myself, and eventually my younger brother, Austin, that manifested in playing ice hockey. I played ice hockey through university and was offered a spot on the Israeli national hockey team after university, which instead I declined to pursue sliding sport for Israel. And that's how I began my skeleton journey in March of 2014.
That's interesting. It also sounds like a successful career in youth sports. But I'm curious, how does somebody go from being offered to join the Israeli hockey team to push that aside and decide to pursue the Israeli sliding sports?
Really, for me, it was a discussion with the alumni director of my school, my high school at the time. His name is Mike Rosenberg. He was the alumni director of Maimonides School, where I went in Boston for day school. And I was talking to him about this decision to pursue or not pursue this opportunity to play for Israel. And he had mentioned that there had been only one or two students to have ever graduated Maimonides to have gone on to play collegiate level sports. And to the best of his knowledge, I believe it was that no one had gone on thereafter to pursue anything else. That to me really brought to my immediate attention that there was some sort of self-perpetuating vicious cycle that was preventing kids from trying to realize their sports dreams, because statistically it shouldn't be that almost no one had from our school had ever gone on to play even collegiate level sport. Taking a look deeper into it, I just realized that there wasn't resources for Jewish kids to pursue their sports dreams, and consequently, how are we ever supposed to raise an entire generation of people who have athletic dreams if they don't have those resources to pursue them? And so I wanted to set an example and use the Olympics as a stepping stone to start a nonprofit, which one day would allow kids, you know, would provide kids the opportunity and the needs, the financial means that they had to pursue their sporting dreams. And that's really where the decision not to pursue hockey came from, because hockey, the marginal benefit of any one player on a hockey team for Israel is not really going to make any difference. Israel is kind of bouncing around between world B and C level to make the Olympics. And hockey, I think you need to be in something like the top 12 in world A level. So Israel, you know, would benefit almost nothing from having me on that team. But in a solo sport where I could power my own Olympic journey and try to make something happen, that was a much higher likelihood.
It makes sense. I'm curious, you mentioned that there's a financial struggle and it's not such a clear path for Jews to pursue sports at a post-collegiate level. Did you have any financial support or leaders who could guide you down a path for your journey from the beginning?
Did I have any athletic Jewish leaders?
Yeah, that or financial support from the beginning.
So I've struggled immensely with the financial aspect of things. I think it's one of the areas that I have tried very hard to draw attention to, which is anyone who wants to pursue higher level sport for Israel or in the Jewish community is largely on their own. And what I mean by that is in 9 years, we've had one essentially recurring sponsor, a very special family, the Gelman family in New York City. And here and there, we've cobbled together $100 here, a couple of $100 there, to try and support things. But on the average, in over the 9 seasons that I've been a member of Bobsleigh Skeleton Israel, I think on average, probably the season is between 10 to 15% funded. And what that means is that other 85%, 80 to 85% will come from savings, borrowing, summer jobs, things like that. So from a financial perspective, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult, which makes it very hard to compete to the best of your ability. If you're constantly worrying about whether the team has the means to feed itself, which has essentially been a constant struggle for the last 3 years. There have been many times where I've just slept in my car because I needed to put a roof over my boys' heads. My boys refers to my brakeman. And I would sleep in a car while trying to get them an apartment. It's been very tough. And you know, it's something that I'm still trying to crack the code on. As good as this team is, an Olympic level bobsled team for Israel, we still this year were not able to find a sponsor other than the Gelmans again. So it's very, very tough.
Wow, it sounds very difficult. I've heard you mention elsewhere that at the beginning you didn't even have so much coaching available. It'd be $40,000 for basic costs, and coaching could double that, and you're spending a lot of time trying to learn from YouTube instead. Where does the motivation come from that powers you to continue pursuing this journey?
Where does the motivation come from? The motivation is essentially that I've always had a very firm belief that if you have a gift, the ability to do something for your community that no one else possibly can, or that Hashem gave you a blessing that you have the passion and the skill to try to make something, you know, to accomplish something. It is a waste. It's geneva. It's stealing if you don't pursue it to a certain degree. And certainly for that, trying to change how Jews and Israelis view sport and their potential in sport has been a prime motivating factor in not stopping. Because the team, if it were just for an additional sponsor last year, this team would have made, you know, would have appeared at the Olympic Games, right? And that was just for lack of having a sled that was competitive. And that's really like a physical bobsled that was competitive. And that's really a shame. And I'm resolved to finish that job. This team will make the Olympics in 2026. I can say it with such certainty, should we find a benefactor. But you know, how could I walk away? If I walk away, this team won't make it, right? Because I'm the pilot, so it would take years to train someone else up. I'm not walking away from that opportunity for Israel. So Israel is going to make it, and we're going to make sure Israel makes it.
That's inspirational. How did you get your team together at the start? Your team is now half Arab and half Jewish. Was it always this way? And I have a feeling that when you looked for people in Israel, the desert wasn't exactly bustling with bobsled competitors. So how did you even put this team together from the beginning?
So how do I put together a bobsled team at the start? It requires a lot of recruitment. So what I did was I went online, I looked at the top athletes for the Israeli rugby team, top athletes in weightlifting for Israel, and sent them Instagram messages. Just said, hey, would you love to represent your beautiful country in the Olympic Games at the Olympic level? Here's what I've done in the past. Here's where this team can go. With your involvement, we can get there. And all the members of the team responded in the affirmative. They were very, very enthusiastic for it and of it. And we have a spectacular group of boys.
That's very nice. You've spoken about the effort and dedication to fundraise and also what it took on a personal level going away from hockey. Can you describe on a technical level to the listeners who have only seen bobsled at the Olympics and nothing more, what goes into it? What's training like? How do you prepare for a competition? Is it always the same? And I guess could we just get more details on, in regards to that part?
Preparing for a competition is very, I'd say it's very similar to most other sports in that you have a date on the calendar and you're training, you're ramping up to being there. What goes into that is, in bobsled particularly, we can only do the sport for about 6 months a year on ice. The rest of the time is sprinting and lifting. It goes entirely into the push. The push is the sprint that we do at the beginning. And so a competition in January, February is going to have been preceded by a couple of months on ice. We start basically in October, November. And that's going to be different from, let's say, the first competition that might start in October, which will have just been resting on the work that we did in the off season from March, April through, you know, through that time period. That will, you know, whether it is the competition in January or it's the competition in November, both of them involve a ton of logistics. Logistical planning is extremely critical. And Bob said it's probably the most logistically intense sport that you can do. Getting a bobsled across the ocean is $10,000, for example. If you can't foot that cost, which we can't most of the time, well, not most of the time, like we just can't. We rent a sled, and that requires finding a person who has a sled, making sure that it's properly maintained. If it's not properly maintained, we need to fix it. Getting the boys across, making sure that they have the right uniforms, the right helmets, the right ice spikes, which is specialized running shoes. Everything that would go into the sport is entirely planned out meticulously by, I guess it'd be myself. Normally you'd have a team manager or something like that, but we don't have a team manager. I take on that role. And that's, you know, when you ask how do you prepare for a competition, there's a ton of I's to dot and T's to cross.
Wow. And what's it like in the actual competition? I think by sports in general, and even more so by the sports that people know less about, where the viewer sees is a bunch of guys running with a bobsled, and then you jump in and try to go as quickly as you can. Can you explain or elaborate on what it's actually like? Are there methods or skills, or is it just a speed and strength competition?
You're asking if there are skills to the pushing aspect of it?
Yeah, and the riding.
So the driving takes years to master. The piloting, the driving is my responsibility. The pushing is the responsibility of either the single person in the back in a two-man race or the three people in the back in a four-man race. There's two disciplines in our sport, a two-man discipline and a four-man discipline. Four-man was popularized by the movie Cool Runnings, in which the Jamaican bobsled team is depicted in the 1988 Olympics. There is a very highly technical aspect to pushing a bobsled. It requires an immense amount of training to get your biokinetic processes moving the correct way. It's not just something like, you know, if someone were to tell you to sprint 30, 40 meters. It's a completely different process, moving a 450-pound object from rest down a sloped hill is not something that's easy to do nor normal for the body. So that requires a ton of training, both during the off season and during the season. One of the reasons that Israel is almost always behind the eight ball in terms of what it has to work with is that even practicing that very specific movement pattern in what's called a practice facility, an ice house, of which there are two in North America, is $200 per hour. And getting people over to those ice houses is also incredibly resource intensive. So well-funded teams, people like the Germans, they'll spend dozens and dozens and dozens of hours in push houses during the off season to perfect their pushing technique. Israel, I'm very lucky if we could afford, you know, time in October, right? The push houses in North America are essentially open from June onwards. It's tough. From the driving perspective, this is over 9 years of driving for me. So this is it takes a lot of time, a lot of hits, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But eventually, you know, for me, the way I learned it was I watched 10 to 12 hours of YouTube video a day. I was told that I was never going to be a competitive athlete in skeleton or bobsled. I was told that I couldn't run well. I was told that I was too short and too small. There was a lot of things that would point to me not being a competitive athlete in the sport. I knew that I could overcome those physical limitations by being the best driver. And so I resolved to essentially speak the language of driving. That manifest, you know, the way I accomplished that was 10 to 12 hours of YouTube per day, watching World Cups, watching point of view videos. And I did that for 4+ years. And eventually it became like a native tongue to me. Entering a corner, if I'm entering at any particular angle, too much to the left, too much to the right, my brain is able to automatically shift gears and know what to do, because at 90 miles an hour, the human response time is not quick enough to adapt. If you're actually thinking, you need to be able to just read and react instantaneously.
Very nice. I think that despite the challenges, you have been recognized in a few different ways. And I'm curious what being honored as a Forbes 30 under 30 was like, and what that means knowing all the challenges you've had to overcome.
Being a Forbes 30 under 30 is, to me, it's almost meaningless. It's, I essentially, I'm proud of it, given that it was related to the efforts with the bobsled team. And so there was a recognition that this team is in some way quite exceptional. Moving forward, you know, it's just something that I could talk to kids about how to strive to achieve certain goals of theirs.
Okay. And in terms of working with the kids, I mentioned you work with Maccabi USA and also coach for other groups. What is it within you that motivates you to give back to the younger generation?
The fact that I think that our community needs it. Our community, without people paying it forward, without being mentors and without being coaches, just does not have the infrastructure to be able to allow children to pursue those dreams. Right? I think of Jared, who there's a very skilled skeleton athlete who succeeded me for Israel, and his name is Jared Firestone. He's a spectacular skeleton athlete, but he's on the verge of retiring because he can't find funds. And this team, 4 years ago, when I wanted to start it in January of 2019, couldn't find a cent, right? And so consequently, the team lost a year, a full year of not being able to compete, not being able to train. The efforts that are spent outside of the team specifically towards kids, towards our community, is to try and break that cycle. Is to try to break the self-perpetuating lack of infrastructure, because there shouldn't ever be a case where someone who wants to be a skilled, a productive athlete from our community just simply cannot afford it. It's wrong. Yeah, I mean, it's like sport, just like education, is a means of self-expression. It's a means of self-development. It's a means of accomplishment. And to not be able to provide that opportunity is, to me, one of the more shameful things that I've come across. We're exceptionally skilled as a community in so many different areas, and in an infrastructure to provide the necessary scaffolding to be successful in sport, we just don't have it.
Okay, if there's a link people can donate to, we'll try to send it around with the episode when it comes out, so the people who are interested can contribute and help your team and future teams. I think we'll conclude with two more questions. One of them is that you've given TEDx talks before where you spoke about your journey. Was that something you went into knowing you wanted to share your story and inspire others? And how do you prepare giving those talks?
For me, talking is something that I forced myself to be familiar and comfortable with. I think I used to have incredible stage fright, not being able at all to speak publicly or to really look people in the eyes and express what I wanted to for any prolonged period of time. And so from the time that I entered the sport and realizing just how hard it would be to represent Israel with a lack of any sort of financial backing, the team having literally zero in over 9 years, literally $0 and zeros, no shekels, I've been provided to this team. You know, from Israel. And so knowing that, I knew that I would need to be able to effectively communicate what I wanted to the public, or to our community especially. And so I watched a lot of talks. I started delivering talks. I drive a lot. It's just part of being an athlete is you just drive a lot. And so whenever I was in the car, I'd give a speech, right? I'd give a talk to myself. And the TEDx talks, I think there are two or three online. They were really born. Those talks were essentially me just speaking in the car, and then eventually I would record it, and the words would just flow and create a speech. And that's really how I prepared and made those talks.
That's very cool. And we'll conclude the episode with the same question every episode ends with, which is, I know you've been on another podcast and have dealt with questions from all types of people across the U.S., Israel, and in other places. But there's always questions people wish they could discuss that they never have the chance to. So, looking back on all the questions you have been asked, what's a question that you've never been asked that you wished you were, and what answer would you give to it?
I think I haven't been asked, for the most part, why would someone want, you know, if someone wanted to understand your passion for sport, or your passion for trying to change things, why is it such a top priority? And, you know, because Because most of the time when I run into the issues with finding sponsorship or donation, even with sports team owners, Jewish sports team owners, they just say it's not in their giving profile, right? It's not an important issue. And I actually do understand that relative to education or relative to genetic diseases, medical things, this doesn't seem like, you know, it doesn't tug at the heartstrings, right? But there is an immense amount of good that comes from kids, young adults, or even adults pursuing sport. It's not just the self-development. It is the representation of the community that it has. It's almost impossible to root against an individual athlete, right? There are a lot of people who are anti-Israel, but once you see someone out there representing the country, if they're in a ring, if they're on the court, how do you root against that guy, right? He's just there. He's trying his best. Sport is a very normalizing and humanizing endeavor. And I think that you know, this team has, it almost exclusively interacts with people who have never met Jews or Arab Israelis before. And given that the team is half Arab, like it's a shock to people that, you know, they see someone that just does not conform to their view of what Israel is. And so the team's lasting good, something that I'll be forever proud of. On my deathbed, what I'll be most proud of when it comes to this team is we've touched people's lives. The boys on the team through their interactions, this team competing, being in places that people have never met Jews before, right? These bobsled tracks are not inside of metropolitan areas. The team has had an incredible effect, and athletes can have an incredible effect. So there's personal and self growth, but there's also communal growth that comes from sports representation. I think it's really, really critical that at some point the community wake up and realize that there's this hole. And if that hole is filled, right? I find it incredible that someone, I think his name is Ryan Terrell. He's on the cusp of, you know, he's as close as a religious Jew has come to making the NBA in a long time, right? And we're all holding our breath, hoping that he makes it. But it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that something like that is so rare, like that we collectively hold our breath, you know, for the first guy. Right, we should have had dozens of people wearing kippot entering, you know, or being viable for the NBA draft. And the reason that we don't, I'm convinced of this, is not because there's no genetic predisposition for us to, you know, we have lactose intolerance, but there's nothing genetically that would make us worse at basketball, right? It's a cycle. It's a self-perpetuating vicious cycle that at some point needs to be corrected and needs to be fixed. And I sincerely hope that this team is just a small stepping stone in that, you know, in that area. And there are many people on our side. There are many people who view this as a noble endeavor, as I believe it is. But I think as a communal priority, it's just not there yet.
Okay. Hopefully there's success both in the fundraising side of things as well as the competitive component, and we'll be able to cheer and support you in the future. Thank you for listening to this past episode of the Jewish Schmooze podcast. To get our latest updates and contact us, you can follow us on Twitter at Jews_Schmooze. If you want to sponsor an upcoming episode, you can reach out to JewsSchmoozeMarketing@gmail.com. And if you give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening on, that'll be tremendously appreciated. Thank you so much, and hope you're looking forward to the next episode also.